I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy has been a decisive vote in hugely important cases in the U.S. for 30 years. One of the last, just this week, was the court's decision upholding President Trump's latest ban on travel to the U.S. from seven countries. The ban affects residents of five Muslim-majority nations, Syria, Libya, Iran, Yemen, and Somalia. It also includes certain individuals from North Korea and Venezuela. The administration bolstered its winning arguments for the ban by pointing to a waiver process that supposedly allows people to apply for exceptions. But some have called that process a fraud. Among them is Chris Richardson. He's a former U.S. diplomat who filed an affidavit in the Supreme Court case, an affidavit which was later quoted by Justice Stephen Breyer in his dissenting opinion. Richardson served in several countries before leaving the State Department earlier this year. Chris, say someone applying for a visa walked into a U.S. embassy a few years ago. Can you explain how granting a visa used to work?
Once you apply online, you get an appointment, you go to the embassy, and you're interviewed by a consular officer. Depending on the type of visa you interview for, the officer is going to measure certain things under a section of the immigration law. And so what we're looking for is to make sure you're not someone who's going to break the law or stay in the country. And we do have a level of security checks, military intelligence databases, biometric screening, and complex risk-based algorithms to determine whether someone might pose a harm to the United States. And so you would run through all of those things, and then based on whether that person qualifies for the visa, you would give it or deny it.
But the key thing is here, it's the consular officer, him or herself,
right,
would make that determination.
For the most part, yes. Now, if someone's name might be a close match to someone else's name, or if the person had certain types of jobs, or if they were involved in certain types of things, then, you know, in those scenarios, we would talk to the visa office in Washington, D.C. for guidance about those issues, if that person might pose a security risk. But it was very narrowly tailored to that specific applicant.
A few weeks ago, you submitted a sworn affidavit to a district court in New York. What did the affidavit say?
The gist of the affidavit is that when you create a system where you have tons of barriers, barriers that didn't exist before, you're discouraging consular officers from making that final decision. One thing that people have to understand about the context of being a consular officer is that you're expected to do 80, 90, 100 visa interviews per day. Speed and efficiency are very, very important. And if you, as an officer, are being told, okay, so if you want to grant a waiver, you can grant a waiver, but you have to talk to your consular manager, and then your consular manager has to talk to the visa office in Washington, D.C., and they might or might not grant it. For a lot of consular officers, the easier answer is just going to be to refuse the visa and not talk to the person and not bring the person in.
So these new barriers that you're discussing, are these things that have been imposed by the Trump administration?
Yes, the first ban came out within days of him being sworn in as president. And, you know, that was poorly written. It basically banned all categories of visas for these individuals from these eight countries. It really wasn't carefully crafted. But as time went on, he learned, or his administration rather, learned methods to make their discriminatory impact carefully hidden. And they used the State Department and Consular Affairs and Department of Homeland Security to push this discriminatory animus. This waiver process alleges that, you know, if the person meets undue hardship, doesn't pose a security or public safety risk, and is in our national interest, that person could then get a visa. But that's all on paper. For practicality purposes and reality purposes, you've just created a new barrier that really discourages officers from bothering to even try to get that person a visa.
If you look at the numbers of visa waivers that have been granted for the past year or so, does it suggest that few are being granted?
Yes. Recently, the State Department admitted to Senator Van Hollen that only about 2% of visa hardship waivers have even been granted. Going back to the context, you have an officer who has maybe 90 to 100 interviews per day. That officer has in his toolbox something called 214B, which in consular parlance means that you as the applicant have to overcome a presumption that you are going to live illegally in the United States. And so you as the applicant have to actually convince that officer within 5 minutes of an interview or even less that you have an undue hardship, that you're not a public safety risk, and that somehow the visa office and your consular manager are both going to agree that issuing you a visa is in the national interest. I don't think that there has to be an instruction from the president or anybody, knowing the way consular officers work and knowing that our natural inclination is to do things in an efficient and fast way. If you, as a consular officer, don't believe that you're going to be able to get this waiver, you're just going to refuse it. And those officers who've gone through trying to apply for the waiver, they've seen that it might not be issued at all.
You ended up leaving the Foreign Service in March, is that right?
Yes.
Can you explain how you came to that decision?
I had personal issues with my father passing away and wanted to be closer to home. But ultimately, I just felt that we as a State Department gave up fighting, that we were outraged during the initial ban, and hundreds of us signed a dissent memo saying that we weren't going to stand for this. And then we stood for it. We stood by. And gradually, as time went on, what was opposition became, for many officers, support, saying, well, some people get waivers, and therefore we should respect this system. And I understand that. I was in the State Department for 7 years. I think that as a consular officer, you do the best job you can do. But I know for me, I really felt that the message we were sending to Muslims throughout the world, and also to people in these quote-unquote whole countries, wasn't the message I wanted to be a part of.
Do you think that if documents or data about the travel ban waiver process, the kind of things we've just been talking about, do you think they'd have an impact on the legality of the travel ban?
It's hard to know because the State Department is sort of keeping those cards close to its vest, right? They don't want people to see these percentages because they don't want people to dig too deeply into it. I think if there's any criticism of the plaintiffs in the Trump v. Hawaii case is that I think all of us were pushing for a quick and steady win rather than going through a rigorous discovery process. And I don't think that future plaintiffs are going to make that same mistake and that they're going to make State Department cough up much more information than they've been willing to cough up thus far. And so, yeah, I think that if we were to release all the information, you would see that maybe this waiver process and exemption process aren't as rigorous as Chief Justice Roberts had suggested in his ruling.
Chris Richardson is a former Foreign Service officer with the State Department. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you so much.